The following program has been brought to you by Tabard Inn. Feast on eclectic American cuisine in their acclaimed restaurant, or enjoy a cocktail and listen to live jazz in one of their cozy Victorian sitting areas. Mingle with travelers from around the world who find the Tabard the only place to stay when their travels bring them to Washington. For more information, visit www.tabardinn.com.
Hi, and welcome to We Dig Plants on the Heritage Radio Network on the internet, broadcasting from two shipping containers outside of Roberta's Pizza at 261 Moore Street in Bushwick, Brooklyn. Right now, I'm sniffing a clementine.
Wintertime.
Pretending that I'm in California. And today's going to have a little bit of a California flavor. I'm Carmen DeVito.
And I'm Alice Marcus Krieg.
We are the garden designers and builders of Groundworks, Inc. We build gardens all over New York City and the surrounding area, and this show aims to bring the culture to horticulture. And today we have a very special guest on our show who we're really pleased to have on. Her name is Sharon Lovejoy, and she is going to be joining us via telephone from her home in California to share about her work as a gardener, as a writer, and an artist. We've been following Sharon's career for some time, but it really touched home for me when I had my son Max. And as a gardener, of course, I wanted to share my love of gardening and the outdoors with him. And there are innumerable statistics about how important it is to introduce kids to the natural world. And there's just as many sources of information on how to do it. But what I think is really special about Sharon's approach, for me, is her combination of a sense of wonder, and you really get that from her books, a sense of wonder about the natural world, and her broad vision of what that comprises. It doesn't just consist of gardening, how-to, or cooking, or recipes. It includes art and science, and she was doing it long before Michelle Obama and Jamie Oliver stuck a spade in the ground.
And her artwork is super sweet.
So yeah. Welcome, Sharon.
Thank you.
Hi, Sharon.
Wow, to be uttered with Michelle Obama and Jamie Oliver.
Well, you know, those are the two new garden superstars. So.
I know.
Just because they, you know, they think it's, they just invented the idea of gardening with children, but it's been.
You know
it's,
what? I think all gardeners are superstars, especially if they take the time to share their knowledge and their love and their passion with youngsters who are our next hope. You know, we have to give that gift to them or we're in trouble.
Exactly.
And actually, I agree with you. I'd like to share with our audience a little bit about your history, Sharon, because okay. your love of gardening sort of came from your experience as a child. From what I had read, for the first 7 years of your life, you were introduced to the wonders of nature by your Quaker grandmother, Abigail Lovejoy. Isn't that right?
That's absolutely right. And we may not have been able to dance or do some other things, but we sure could garden. And she was a marvelous gardener. And I have to say that I honestly didn't realize the gift she gave me till I was a teenager. And I was with a group of friends, and we were chewing on sweet fennel, which really carpets a lot of the hillsides in Southern California.
Uh-huh.
And somebody reached for some hemlock and started to put it in their mouth. And I said, stop. And if you've ever looked at poison hemlock, Conium maculatum, which was Socrates' last drink,
yeah.
If you look at it, it looks like it has blood dots on its stem. And I said, stop, that's poison. And they said, how do you know? And I said, my grandma told me, look for the blood dots, you never eat that. And it just started coming back to me. So I know that we lose our children sometimes as they get up and their peer pressure is important. But this kind of knowledge that you give them when they're really young, it flows back to them and enriches their lives in so many ways.
Agreed. Well, after your experience, your sort of practical experience with your grandmother, you also studied art, isn't that right, at San Diego State?
I did. And I remember my mom saying, how are you going to earn a living doing art? And I've earned a living for over 20 some years doing art, and probably many of my college professors said the same things. They said you draw too small, you're doing too much realistic stuff. But what I learned is that you follow your heart, you go for the joy factor, and when you do and you work hard at it, I mean, a lot of it is about tenacity, it can pay off, and it has. I'm so lucky. I have Workman Publishing in New York City, and I'm very close to everybody there involved in the creation of my books. And they're 100% for me. And they've let me deviate from the norm a little bit and really express myself. And I'm really thankful, because to me, communicating a passion and a love and knowledge is the whole thing. Whether it's my art, whatever it is, if you really sit down and look, I try to share those little gems, those little bits of trivia that children and adults love.
Well, I also read that you also had a garden and herb shop
in
Cambria, California. Tell us a little bit about that.
Well, Cambria is right by Hearst Castle, and by actual count, we had over 100,000 visitors a year to our little garden, which was a quarter acre. And it was in a property that my husband and I owned that had a barn and a little 1880s cottage on it. We bought it from Angela Lansbury, the movie star. She owned that property. And her brother-in-law had an antique shop there, and it was full of junk. And when he passed away, it was going to be sold, and I wrote Angie a letter and thought I'd never hear from her. Sent her a portfolio of my work and said I wanted to teach classes and, you know, all this stuff. And one day her business manager called, and he drove the 230 miles up to Cambria, spent the day with me. At the end of the day, shook our hands and said, Angie would love to sell you this property. And then when she had her brother-in-law's funeral ceremony, it was held in our newly created gardens, and she looked around and she got tears in her eyes, and she said, I feel as though I'm in Britain. I feel as though this garden's been here 100 years, but really it had only been there less than a year. It was a miracle garden.
Well, that was all your experience coming to fruition.
It was. And also I had the slave labor of my sons and my husband and
labor's
all my
good.
Friends.
Yeah.
You know, but my sons were just, they fought it every step of the way. And then after the garden was in, I'd hear them out there and they'd say, well, I did this. I built this bed.
Right.
It was all raised, you know, and I planted this. This lemon verbena is my baby. And I just thought,
that's so
boy.
Interesting. It's really gratifying to hear that, because my son is 11 and he resists, you know. And then, you know, sometimes when I'm not around or he doesn't think that I'm listening, he'll have his friends over and he'll say, yeah, that's my mom's herb garden. And he's able to identify every single plant. And he'll say, you know, try the fennel and you can just eat that. And, you know, but, you know, he won't admit it to me. You know, he'll say, well,
I'm
not interested in that.
Is that your Max, your 11-year-old?
That's my Max. I only have one.
Oh, boy.
So,
well, you've given him a gift already, and he won't, you know, he'll carry that forever, and that's so important. I know moms and dads work full time, and some people work way more than full time, and may work two jobs. So, if they can just take some time on a weekend or when they have a little bit of time, even to grow something in a coffee can or a plastic bag. I mean, I don't care what you grow it in, and that's why in Root Shoots, Buckets, and Boots, I went out of my way to show that you can grow things in tiny containers, in big, funny containers, in boxes, in all sorts of things, and really transfer to children that sense of wonder and the amazing feeling of being a parent to something. I've heard kids yell, I'm a mother to a carrot.
I had never thought about it that way. That's an interesting, that's a very... a childlike and sweet way of thinking about it, which leads me to ask you this question. In all your books, and they have, you know, this certain sensibility about them, you sort of combine the gardening, cooking, nature study, and science, and you create what I see as kind of a quieter, sort of slower paced and more magical world than the real world that we live in. How do you personally stay inspired in this sort of like high speed, you know,
internet age
with constant electronic interruptions? How do you continue to find that wonder?
Well, I don't mean puns are the lowest form of humor, but gardens keep me grounded. They really do,
mm-hmm.
as do all the children in my life. But every day of my life, even in the rain, even in a windstorm, I go out and get in touch with what's going on. And when my family's had new children, and they've just been a few days old, I'll take them out and go to my scented pelargoniums and run their little pink fingers over a peppermint pelargonium or, you know, apple or nutmeg, and just talk to them, and getting them in touch keeps me in touch. It reinforces it. I know when I wrote Sunflower Houses, my son was quite young, and I said that he reinfected me with childhood. He reawakened me. He gave me new eyes on the magic of childhood and how to view the earth. I do slow down. I get a lot of emails every day from readers, dozens and dozens and dozens, and questions, but that early morning time when I get back and get on my knees out in the garden and pull out Scarlet Pimpernel that's insinuated its way into my wildflower patch, or, you know, work on my lettuces, it really grounds me, and I think it could help everyone if they even grow things indoors to be in touch with something. I'm sure you do this too. I talk to my plants every day.
A really sad statement that Carmen and I hear a lot from a lot of our clients is, oh, I have a black thumb. I can't do this at all.
Oh, I'm tired of that.
It's so boring to me, because I think
it's a cop out.
Have
it's
you even tried? You know, like, come on. You can, like you're saying, get that coffee can, get some soil, and try something. You know, try that bean, try
that's
that sunflower.
Right.
You know, it's
that's
really
right.
easy.
You know, my granddaughter was staying with me, and it was a rainy day, and I was making bean soup, and I said, and I wrote about this in Toad Cottages and Shooting Stars, I said, Sarah, do you want to cook them all or do you want to rescue some? And she said, rescue. So we poured them into a bowl of water. Some of them floated. We knew those were dead. Mm-hmm. The ones that sank, we planted into a big terracotta pot of soil. And within the next 2 weeks, it was an amazing thing to see all those beans come up. She felt so proud and so connected to the garden. And, you know, she didn't know that she could grow something, and no one knows until they try. And I always remember this Russell Page quote that was that a green thumb is the product of a verdant heart. And, you know, I feel sorry for people who say they have a black thumb, because they're missing out on one of the biggest joys of life.
Yeah, and so many people just have no idea where their food even comes from these days, and they won't even try it, you know?
No.
You're saying, you know, that was bean soup, but it turned into this whole analogous... Yeah, just
that's right.
An amazing situation that, you know, where learning actually occurred, and it wasn't just bean soup on a cold day.
No, it wasn't, and there's so much life force wrapped up in the starts of plants and, you know, cuttings. I mean, if you could see all the rosemaries I have growing in this little garden that were side garnishes on plates, I can't stand to throw them away. I always root them. I've got about 7 different varieties of rosemary in the yard, and they all almost ended their lives on the side of a plate. I guess what I want to say is people need to understand that spark of life is in everything. And when I did my windowsill garden projects, and I have some going right now too, for instance, just getting a kohlrabi at the market and putting it at the top of a vase and letting it sprout and letting it get leaves and bloom, it's such an amazing feeling, even when you're a grown-up.
Yeah, I mean, even
God
that...
God forbid I should be a grown-up.
even that simple avocado, you know?
Yes.
Toothpicks in an avocado is... like pure joy on the windowsill.
I have a great book. Alice and I worked at the Horticultural Society of New York for years, and one of our great friends was the librarian there, Catherine Powis, and we would get, when she was cleaning house, she would get rid of her gardening books.
It was basically the foundation of our library.
Yeah, she would give them, you know, she'd sell them to us for, you know, a pittance. It was just really...
Oh, wonderful.
So I have a great collection of gardening books, and one of my favorites is called, and it's a classic from the 70s. It would never get published today. It's called the After Dinner Gardening Book, and it's about all the pits and stuff left on your plate after
wonderful.
Dinner that you can't grow. And it's so quintessential.
I'm writing that down.
Yeah.
You should get wonderful. It would definitely there were some wonderful things in there about all the, you know, they were having their wonderful dinner parties, and then don't throw out your pits. You can plant them.
And I know there was another group in New York City who got together once a month, and I cannot remember the name of them, but they all grew things, for instance, ginger from ginger cuttings, and that was very inspirational to me, to think of all these people in these New York City apartments growing ginger.
It must
and
have
growing.
Been one of the plant societies.
Yes, I bet
it
was.
Yeah, and it was a funny little one, and I can't remember it. Maybe some of your listeners will, you know, write to you. But I wrote some notes to them, and I just loved, and they had reviewed my book Trial and Error, so I got a Google alert, and that's how I found out about them.
Uh huh.
And it was wonderful. In fact, I need to go back and find them again because so much knowledge there.
Yeah.
People who grew everything in their apartments.
Yeah.
They definitely had green thumbs and verdant hearts.
Well, we have to take a break right now. Just stay on the line. We'll be back with
I'll
you in
that.
2 seconds. You're listening to We Dig Plants on the Heritage Radio Network.
Oh, firefly, I'll watch you as you go now. Go flying by, tell me how you glow now. Every evening there's a show, stars above and down below. Crazy lights are everywhere, you bring the magic of summer to the air. Firefly, lighting up the breeze now.
Hi, welcome back. We have Sharon Lovejoy on with us. You're listening to We Dig Plants on the Heritage Radio Network. We were just flipping through some of your books, and one thing that I love being an art person is I love these drawings that you do. They're very delicate, and I especially like the individual plant portraits in your sunflower houses. What inspired your style? And I'm assuming they're all done by hand.
They are. You know, I started writing before computers did artwork.
Mm-hmm.
And I keep a journal.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, if you looked at my book, Trial and Error, many of the drawings in Trial and Error came out of my daily journal.
Yeah, that's what it looks like. Yeah.
Right. And many of the drawings in Toad Cottages and Shooting Stars came out of my journal. I do quick, simple sketches with a pencil. I go back to my studio and I use a Micron 005 pen, and I use washes of watercolor and gouache, and I use watercolor pencils and just plain colored pencils.
Mm-hmm.
And I love my studio, and I have a children's studio set up there too for my grandchildren, and they have their own workstations, although they're PlayStations, with mm-hmm. rolls of paper and every kind of tool you could imagine for making art.
You sound like the perfect grandmother.
I know. Can you adopt me?
Can I come hang out with you?
I wish you could. Well, have you had a chance to see our little garden here in Country Gardens magazine?
No, not yet.
Oh, it's in. I had gotten a message from you, and it says something about country living, but it's in the Better Homes and Gardens Country Gardens magazine. And
okay.
It's a good example of what a small, and it is a small lot, a 9,000 square foot city lot, we've managed to cram in 60 fruit trees.
Wow.
Actually, we have 64 trees, and many of them are dwarf species and giant terracotta pot.
Uh-huh.
We grow all sorts of foods here, all kinds of strawberries, and I want people to realize how great it is to grow their own food. I want people to realize that they can do it in a small area. And also in that article in Country Gardens, it shows some of my journal pages. And I'm out working in the garden one day when my girlfriend Lynn took a picture. So that there's that, too. So you can see my setup and the watercolors and everything.
That's interesting. It looked, from the photos that I saw, it looked a lot larger.
No, it's not.
Interesting.
My other garden up in Cambria, where we had our community gardens that we tended, I had almost a 1 acre garden and then a quarter acre. But what people have to realize is that you can get so many plants into a small space.
Yeah,
and I can make a testimony to that.
No, you really can. I completely am in support of that. It's amazing what a small space can give you.
Well, we usually
vertical.
Yes, that's true. Well, we work in urban environment, and we have most of the gardens that we make are, you know, under 600 or 700 square feet, and
yeah.
you
Good.
Know, and people have high expectations of that square footage, and we're able to make real environments for them to enjoy at many different
that's
levels.
Awesome. Yeah.
So
well, I'd love to see some of yours next time I'm in New York City. I'll be turning in my new manuscript in June, and maybe we can somehow visit some of your gardens.
Oh, please.
We would love to give you the tour.
Yeah.
I'd love that. I'm curious.
That would be really great. So we noticed that you also spend part of the time each year in Maine and then in Southern California, where you are calling in from now. Tell me a little bit about Maine, my favorite place.
Oh, it's my favorite place, too. I fell in love with it when I was a child, and I read the work of Sarah Orne Jewett, Country Doctor, Country of the Pointed Fur. And so there I was, a landlocked California girl in love with this island-dotted magical place. So when I was quite young, I went there, fell in love with it, and started going every summer. When I met my husband, I said, how do you feel about Maine? And he said, I don't know, and that was the test.
Yeah.
And we bought our place 16 years ago. At Christmas Cove, which is mid-coast Maine, and it's right on the water. It was part of the Miles Fresh Air Camp. We got the old, it was the old bunkhouse or dormitory, and we fixed it up for a Country Living article. I mean, we fixed it up for ourselves, but it was featured in Country Living. And it is colorful. We are in touch with the dolphins and the whales and the, you know, the alewives running and the elvers, and we feel like when we're in Maine that we're the luckiest people in the world.
Yeah, Maine has that effect, and the blueberry pie.
Oh my gosh! Well, we have a blueberry patch. It's small. We've kept our yard. We feel it's only half an acre, but we feel that it's the most perfect garden in the world because it's blueberries and bayberries and wild lilies and pink lady slippers. Mm-hmm. And then what we do to grow lettuces, and of course I always have to have sunflowers and heavenly blue morning glories, we have lots of containers, and we have window boxes, and we just cram them full of all kinds of good things.
So you have gardens on the opposite ends of the continent, very, very different gardens, as you described.
I know, but it's so different because I spend a lot of time, probably 20 hours a week, in my garden here in California working. And in Maine, it's like my winter because my garden is so small. It takes maybe an hour a day.
Right.
And yet it brings it up close. We eat all our meals in a screen porch facing the ocean. And all of the bumblebees and butterflies and dragonflies are visiting these tiny microcosms. And it's a wonderful experience. I love the difference of the two experiences.
I would imagine. And you offer lodging at your place in Maine, don't you, Sharon?
Well, it's not that we offer lodging at our little cottage on the ocean. We have a building in Damariscotta, Maine.
Oh,
I don't know
if
you've ever been there.
No.
We're right by Maine Coast Books and the theater. And in Damariscotta, we have a view out the front of the Damariscotta River and out the back of the river in a back bay. And we call it Comfort Found. And it's considered to be literary lodging. It has a couple bedrooms and a kitchen and lots of artwork and gazillions of books, the most comfortable beds in the world. And it's just a new venture Jeff and I thought would be fun to offer people a place to stay in a quintessential New England village. It is, Damariscotta is my favorite village in the world, with restaurants all around, walking distance, 1 minute from the water. You know, it's wonderful. So we are Comfort Found in Maine.
I spent a lot of time in Kennebunkport growing up as a kid, and we would go there every summer. And, I mean, the blueberry pancakes in the morning in Maine are just, it's just beautiful.
So everything tastes better in Maine.
It does, yeah.
So you have to walk every day for those blueberry pancakes can settle on your hips.
Exactly. So I was just flipping through through your book, Trowel and Error, and you quote Virgil.
I love Virgil.
Yeah, and the quote reads, "And let no idle spot on earth be found, but cultivate the genius of the ground." So what does that mean for you?
It means that, watch out, as my husband said, you plant every square inch. What I think that means to me is that the earth is magical, it's full of miracles, and that every bit of it, even the most harsh piece of desert, if given water, will grow something. And when I started reading Virgil's poems, it was, I would say, probably the biggest eye-opener for somebody who's involved in agriculture or gardening to read his poetry about gardens and agriculture. And I have little slate boards all around my garden where I've quoted him, because I really believe that he got it, that this is a miracle. The soil that we have that we take for granted, walk on and treat like dirt, it's full of miracles. And my husband said, don't you leave an inch of the soil unplanted? I don't. I even if I mulch, what I do is I have underplantings in every area. So I'm not wasting any of that ground. I want to make sure I cover it all.
Yeah, there's enough plants to go around.
Truly, truly.
Well, we're fond of that too, especially when you're dealing with small, you know, small spaces. Every we always say that the plants have to pay their rent, and they have, you know, spaces at a premium, so they have to, you know, they have to look good and be happy where they're at, you know.
I love it that you said the plants have to pay their rent. I, you know what?
That's a New York statement, I guess, Sharon.
I love
it's all about
that.
Real estate.
I just, you know, I think of things like underplanting with different species of thyme, and making or maybe trending chamomile or something, so that you're right, they're paying their rent. They're mm-hmm. they're earning their keep there. That's wonderful. Thank you, New Yorkers.
You know, as you look through your books, it's hard to tell what your first love is. Is it writing, or is it illustrating, or is it gardening?
Well, I have to say I'm a writer.
Okay, that's how you define yourself, as a writer.
I do feel that I have been very, very lucky to earn my living doing something I'm passionate about. And right now, I'm writing a new book for Workman, and it's a bird book, believe it or not, a bird book for 5 to 9 year olds, and to get them excited about the world that's right outside their windows, even if they do live in a New York apartment. And so I'm very excited about that.
I think that's great, yeah.
But I'm also writing, I have two middle grade children's novels that I'm working on, and one is, I'm actually going today, an agent is going to listen to it today, and I'm going to be reading part of it, and I love writing literature for children, and I'm not talking about, you know, trash. I'm not talking about something easy to come out. I'm talking about something laced with history and ethnobotany and bird lore, so that it's multi-layered.
Yeah, that makes me want to read it.
Good. I'll send it to you.
Please do.
We'd love to have you back and talk more about your new works.
Thank you.
Well, one of the latest book, which was Trial and Error, one of the things that I find most interesting, and Alice and I have been gardening for years, and I found so much helpful information in. I was wondering if you could share a few of the tips from that book with our audience. I especially like the willow water recipe, which is something that I had never heard of.
Well, that's something that my grandmother did, but you know what I started doing, and first I should say, Trial and Error was written in 2003, I believe, and I've had, I think, three more books come out since then, and Toad Cottages and Shooting Star just came out a few months ago.
Oh, okay.
So that's my newest one, and it has an amalgam of everything that's in the other books. And I just wanted to say that when I was growing up, my grandmother kept in her refrigerator a mason jar that had a lid on it, and I would see her soak starts of plants in that, and I didn't really understand why. I didn't have any clue why. So what I started doing when I was looking through my journals, and I did mention that they took my journals in which I draw and make notes, and they use that as the basis of the book Trial and Error. And I remembered writing about willow water and thinking about, well, I wonder why that works. So I started doing the checking on the scientific reasons behind a lot of the things that are in Trial and Error. And I found out about how the willow tips, it's usually the growing young tips and the new green leaves, that's the protoplasm that has more of the compounds in them that cause things to root. And one of the things that is in willow water is indole-butyric acid, salicylic acid, and rhizokaline. And all these things are stimulants. And indole-butyric acid is called IBA, and that's part of the rooting compounds we buy now as a powder. You know how you mm-hmm. wet a tip and
rootone.
Well, that's
yeah.
got IBA. Yeah, it's got IBA. Yeah, rootone. It's got IBA in it. But I've always just used willow water, and I have a great big enamel pot out in the garden, and I fill it with rainwater, and I cut a lot of those new willow clippings and twigs and soak them in that for about a week. And then I bottle up that water. It turns a kind of a murky, browny gold. And I don't keep it longer than a week because it'll get stinky and it starts sort of spoiling. Mm-hmm. And then I bottle up that the water in willow water and put them in my extra fridge. And I use that for starting things during the year. I do that even for begonias and, you know, pelargoniums and all sorts of things. So it has all the compounds that you want to start things, to get things off to a good start. Now, last year I started doing more research on it, and I found that master gardeners in Rhode Island are using willow water and salicylic acid aspirin to, they're testing it on different patches of their garden, and they're finding out that the things that are either drenched in salicylic acid aspirin or willow water do much better than the other plants that are started. So it's just an amazing circle of knowledge that starts from the natives who discover this, mm-hmm. who realize that there's this potential for growth in these things that root so easily. It's used as an accompaniment to that knowledge. It's passed on to our families, to our ancestors, mm-hmm. and it comes up through the ranks and it ends up being tested out scientifically, and it's true. Well, it's not always true about all of those things that are passed on to us, but it certainly is true about willow water.
Oh, great. That sounds great. I can't wait to try that.
And aspirin, plain old 325 milligram uncoated aspirin dropped in. And I've got all this in trial and error, and you've got the you know, exactly how much to use. And that's the salicylic acid again, and it's used to treat sick plants just as a chamomile tea is used mm-hmm. to fight fungus and mildew and things. Mm-hmm. It's just amazing.
There's a big trend here in New York with compost tea. And I know that Battery Park City uses a lot of that to fertilize sure. their plants. So, yeah, it's a similar idea.
My poor husband, I was getting my compost and soaking, putting it in his socks. Well, he had socks that were pretty bad anyhow, I thought. And then I would just drop them into my various watering. I have about a dozen watering cans around right. the garden. And he said, I've got one of everything. And I said, but you can use those wonderful plasticky or meshy things that onions come in.
Yeah.
And those are a good thing for soaking your compost.
Right.
And, of course, you have to do big chunkers when you're doing compost tea. And don't leave it in too long because it'll get bad. They have all kinds of machines and all sorts of things. Simple is better.
Yeah.
Yeah. We work in container gardens a lot because in the city we have to, you know, put plants to containers on roofs and things like that. And liquid, you know, we can't put it in the ground. There is no ground. So we have to use liquid fertilizer.
Drenches,
You know, we can't use granular. Sometimes can't put compost. So we use compost tea or things, natural things like fish emulsion and stuff
seaweed,
like that.
Yeah.
Which leads me to our talk about, you know, as you probably noticed, this radio network is very food-focused.
Good.
And to try to get people to eat better and to make better choices with their food.
Good.
And to plant their own food.
And to plant and grow their own food and realize how much power, you know, their pocketbooks have.
That's right.
So I wanted to have you share with our audience how you think it best to equip a kitchen with kids in mind and how to get them excited about cooking and what kind of, you know, implements and things should be in a kitchen if children are going to use it.
Right. I keep, we don't have an island in our kitchen. Our house was built in 1930. We have a long, 7 foot long old work table that we use, and it's just the right height for children. It's quite a bit lower than countertops. And I think I sent you a picture of mm-hmm. some of my grandchildren working. And then we also keep a drawer at child height, and it has their rolling pins, their miniature cake pans, everything that they go right to it, and they know exactly where their tools are. So it's all about making things accessible and having them at their height.
Scale.
And I'm not a proponent of putting children up on a stool to work. It's too dangerous, especially when you're in a kitchen. So that's why I have everything down at child height. And I really think that just making it not a job. I had a friend come who wanted to teach the kids how to do a certain kind of cooking, and he made it so difficult for them that their eyes started rolling back in their heads.
Yeah.
It has to be something short and sweet. And in Toad Cottages, I have all of these really simple things and a list of the equipment that you should have for kids, a small rolling pin, small spatula, you know, knives that are butter knives and they don't have a sharp edge but that they can still cut with. And just the point is, get it at their height, make it accessible, and then do the simplest recipes you can. And if you're growing lettuce, which everyone should be, and if you're growing carrots, and if you're growing radishes, let the kids harvest them, have their own little colander, rinse them out outside, bring them in, and prepare them fresh. We do salad bar parties. We do, you know, anytime we can get the kids to harvest fresh, that's the best way.
And, you're right, you don't need a lot of space to do it.
No. And, you know, I had a little boy who came to one of my classes, and I pulled a handful of carrot seeds out, and I said, what do you think these are? Or, no, I asked first, where do you think carrots come from? And they said, the truck, the Cookie Crock Market, you know, I had everything. And I pulled out a handful of seeds from my gardening apron, and I said, the carrots come from this. I held a carrot in one hand, and this little boy, Bodie, yelled, that's a miracle. And I thought, it is, and that's what we want the kids to know. Let them feel the seeds. There are so many great catalogs out there they can go through and pick what they want, or go to a farmer's market.
Yeah.
You know, let them feel the seeds, let them plant them, give them some small plants that are already started to get rid of the frustration factor. But grow food, and that's all I grew in my new book. I wanted to connect kids to the kitchen, and all my food projects are small in containers because you don't want to frustrate kids. And I even have a garden that's growing in a bale of hay.
Oh, I love that. I love that. It's a great...
It is incredible. You would not believe how easy it is. Schools could do it very easily. And it is so much fun. And then when they're done growing in that bale of straw, they can use it to, top all their beds or their pot.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, unfortunately, we're out of time today, Sharon, but please, let's do stay in touch. And
I'd love that.
And when you're here in June, maybe we could get you back on the show here in the station.
I'd love that, and I want to see some of your gardens. I've always craned my neck and tried to see rooftop gardens, and I've never been in one.
Oh, okay.
We'll give you a private tour.
It's a done deal.
You two are wonderful. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Sharon.
Take care of Max.
Okay, thank you.
Bye.
Well, you've been listening to the Heritage Radio Network and We Dig Plants. A big thank you to Roberta's Pizza at 261 Moore Street in Bushwick, Brooklyn, and to our sponsor. Our show today was produced and engineered by Jack Inslee. Please join us on our Facebook fan page, Groundworks Inc. We Dig Plants. We'd love your feedback, and we'll be posting a link to Sharon's blog and her website shortly. Thanks for listening.
Happy gardening.